This is Michael Matheson Miller, and you are listening to the Moral Imagination Podcast. Thank you again for listening to the Moral Imagination Podcast. And before we get started, I just want to thank all of you who have written reviews of the podcast. If you like the podcast, please go to Apple Podcasts and give it a 5-star review. And also thanks to all of you who have supported me on Patreon. It does really help me get the podcast out, so I appreciate it. Finally, as always, all the show notes will be on themoralimagination.com. You can find links to the books that I discuss, to this and all other podcasts, and notes for all my other past podcasts. And also, you can subscribe to the Moral Imagination Michael Matheson Miller newsletter, which I send out occasionally, where I have updates to some of the podcasts that have come out, or some essays I've written, or also just some reviews of some books that I'm reading. I'm always reading something. So a couple of essays there, or links and recommendations. And you can subscribe at themoralimagination.com. So again, thank you for listening and thanks for your support. And I'm delighted to have as my guest today, Edward Habsburg. He is Hungary's ambassador to the Holy See and the Sovereign Order of Malta. His family reigned in Austria, the Habsburgs, of course, Hungary, Germany, and Spain, and a lot of other places. Also known as Archduke Edward of Austria, he is a diplomat and on social media personality. Edward and his wife, Baroness Maria Theresia von Gudens, have 6 children. Edward is the author of several books, including the children's books Dubby, the Double-Headed Eagle, volumes on Thomas Aquinas, James Bond, Harry Potter, novels, and screenplays. And he is the author of the recent book, The Habsburg Way, 7 Rules for Turbulent Times. And I'm delighted to have Edward on the show. Thank you for joining the Moral Imagination Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me on your show, Michael.
Your book is a very interesting. It's really kind of like a family history, and you go through a number of ideas and insights that you've gotten from your family. And one of the ideas that you have is to know who you are. And I think that's, maybe we'll start here with this idea of knowing who you are. And the reason I start that way is I think in a lot of modern contemporary life, one of the problems we have is we don't know who we are. And I did an interview with Mary Eberstadt, who wrote a really great book called Primal Screams. And Mary argues that one of the sources of identity politics is that we're not connected to our families. And then I did another interview with a man named James Poulos called Human Forever, where he talks about, really, especially in a hyper-technical society and an increasingly individualist society, to know who you are matters. And so it strikes me, I mean, it's a little maybe easier for you to know who you are because you can go to the museums to see pictures of your ancestors. And most of us can't do that. But you do mention this idea of know who you are. Can you talk just a little bit about why you're struck, especially today, from your experience and as a diplomat, why does it matter to know who you are? And how should we be thinking about that? And how can we maybe cultivate in our lives and our families this knowledge of who we are to resist some of the fragmentation that goes along?
Well, Michael, I absolutely agree that this is a core point of the book. And I have to say that we live in a world where our technocratic rulers are trying to divide us apart from our families, from what we are, trying to tell us that we can be something today and something else tomorrow, that we have no connections to our ancestors, no connections to the values of our family, no connections to anyone around us. There's just us and the screen of the phone or of the computer, and that's how you will be happy. That's more or less what we're being told today. And this, of course, goes against anything that humans have experienced over the last 20, 30, 40,000 years. It was different all that time. It's just now that we're trying to follow these new ideas, and these new ideas lead us into loneliness and unhappiness. So what I'm trying to say with this point is, for everybody today, is try to find out who you are by finding out who you are personally, whether you're a man or a woman, whose child you are, what your parents' values were, what the grandparents' values were, where you come from, what you stand for. And if you have these things, then the ever-changing wind of today's society won't blow you over, then you can stand for yourself. But this, of course, is easier if you're a Habsburg, because you have a ready-made identity that is being proposed to you. You can either accept it or, of course, renounce to it, or you can adapt it and try to see what does that mean for me today. But as you said before, I go into museums and I see portraits of ancestors hanging there. I know even too much where I come from. I can trace you a family tree that leads back to the year 1273, more or less. I can visit ancestors' tombs in Switzerland that are 1,000 years old. So I have it a bit easier, I have to say. But this, I mean, in the end, this goes for everybody. What I like to say to people who say they don't have Habsburg ancestry, that doesn't only go for Habsburgs. You may be at the beginning of a great dynasty with your family and your 7 children, Michael, and the values that you and your wife represent will be the values of your children. So this is something we have to think about a lot. And I have to say, as a Catholic, of course, tradition is something that comes automatically to me. I have a problem with people who think that we have to reinvent our faith every 10 years. We can look back on a rich history of tradition in the Catholic Church. And the same goes for being a Habsburg and thinking about things, what is family, and what is marriage, what is identity. All of this are important topics.
Great. Yeah, I think being attentive to that, James Poulos argues in this interview I did with him, just how important it is that we pay attention to who we are, our parents, our grandparents, our ethnicity, our historical studies, not in a sense of exclusion, but to know that we actually do come from somewhere. And one of the themes of this podcast is that we're embodied persons, but we're also embedded persons. And I've talked about this a lot before, so listeners will be familiar with it. But the idea of embeddedness is that we are embedded in deep levels of complexity. So we're embedded in tradition. So for example, we're having this conversation, we're using Zencastr and computers, but what's taking place is actually very complex. We're not just technologically complex, right? But both of us are in different rooms. They're being held up by, you know, the concrete and wood and rebar, depending where you are. And we're using an inherited cultural artifact called the English language that developed over time. And we're embedded in complexity. And like my colleagues and I did a little film at the 25 minutes called The Wonder of Coffee on how complex and difficult it is to get one single cup of espresso. It takes, you know, thousands of people all over the world just to get a single cup of espresso. And so we're embedded in tradition. And I think being aware of our embeddedness and developing some gratitude and awareness, I think is also part of knowing who we are, right? That we're not just simply this radical individual who popped out of nowhere, right? In the myth of the state of nature. And we have ancestors and tradition and culture and language. And that helps situate us as a person who's not just to be a reed. And in your ancestors, for example, I mean, you have a difficulty as well. You have a blessing because it's very clear. You have some fantastic ancestors and you have some bad ancestors, right? Like we all do. And I think getting to know, even being aware to that, I like how you said, we each have a choice to make of how we're going to live and what values we're going to appropriate and then pass on to our children, I think is really important. How do you think about this idea of embeddedness? And why did you stress, again, I'm kind of repeating this question, why is it so important to know who you are?
Because I am terribly aware of the pull and the draw of the internet. The pull and the draw of the phone, the pull and the draw of the technological world, that for obvious reason, once you're single, unhappy, and totally glued to the screen. And it helps to have a family. Now, one of the other topics of the book is get married and have lots of children. If you are married and lots of children, you're automatically grounded. You're automatically based, as one says nowadays. And you know who you are. It jumps into your face every day when you wake up and two of your children jump onto you. You know where you are, what you stand for, what you work for, what you live for. A family automatically grounds you in reality. But as I say, it is very difficult. There is a strong pull on you by a technology that's getting more and more attractive, more and more involving. And I believe that in a few years' time, it will be even more difficult to escape the gravitational pull of modern technology and of entertainment technology. And therefore, we have to make a conscious effort to fight against that. And grounding yourself in your own identity and your embedding where you belong is incredibly helpful and will make you happy, far happier than the things that internet, Twitter, and all the other things. No, it's called X now. It's so ridiculous. Throw at you.
Yeah, I think this idea that you know, Alexis de Tocqueville, right, brought up this worry in modern life that we're going to have individualism, and that individualism leads to centralization, and that centralization wants and encourages individualism. And so I think this idea of we know who we are, that we're grounded in the family, that we take seriously our social nature. So we're embodied, embedded persons with a social nature. And within a family, it helps to give you this sense, as you said, of groundedness. And this is, again, what Mary Eberstadt brings up. Last thing on this, you know, it's not only family. And I'm just kind of jumping around in your book a little bit, but it's not only family, it's important, but you need to be involved in community, what's often called social capital, right? Or what Tocqueville calls intermediary associations. And one of the things you talk about in your book is the importance of the idea of subsidiarity, yes, where you're participating not just as an individual and the state, but you're an individual in a family, in multiple communities, including the church and other communities. How important, and how do you think about the importance and then how to develop community? How do you talk about that?
Incredibly important. If you look at photographs from the 40s, 50s, 60s from children playing, if you pop in the DVD of La Strada of Fellini, which is from the 50s, and you look at the village community, you see children playing outside. You see lots of children playing together. You see people spending a lot of time with their neighbors' children, all of that. Again, I have to come back to the crazy time we live in, where all of this has gone. There is a series of photographs that a famous American photographer took of countryside communities over the decades. And you see less and less and less people and children playing outside because you're sitting in front of your screen. And this, as you said before, and as Tocqueville, apparently I have to read about this, very interesting, has already speculated about, is if you are not connected to your surroundings, to the family, to the neighbors, to your local communities, to your parish, then you drift away from reality. You become alone, you become helpless, and you become a slave to the machine. And I believe it's incredibly important. When I speak about subsidiarity, I speak about a very important element that exists in the Habsburg Empire, but also in the United States, because you are United States. And you are built bottom up. You're built from family, township, county, slowly up. And you should have less and less power on the higher levels. That's the strength of the United States. It's the strength of the myth you're built upon. On the other hand, since a few decades, or at least, I say 60, 70 years, the federal level is getting stronger and stronger. And above the federal level, you have the global level that is exercising a strong power on today's politics and today's world. And the antidote to that is family, is local community, is thinking locally very strongly. And that's what subsidiarity is about, the respect for the lower level that the Habsburgs very strongly encouraged over the centuries, and the United States should encourage, because you have it in your matrix.
You know, I think in subsidiarity, and maybe a quick definition for listeners, so that the idea of subsidiarity in Catholic social teaching is where you see it, but it actually, you see variants in different places. And the idea is different from European Union subsidiarity, right? So subsidiarity means that those closest to the problem handle the problem, and only when they can't do it, do you go to the next level where subsidium, where assistance takes place. And this kind of goes up the chain. But I think one thing that's really important that a lot of people don't understand, and you see this, I think, and you can comment on this. I mean, you're an ambassador to the Holy See and Hungarian. So you can comment, maybe correct me if you think I'm misrepresenting. But oftentimes the European Union notion of subsidiarity is more like a devolution of power. So the center has everything and then it kind of assigns or delegates power.
That's but the total contrary of what it originally is.
Exactly. But subsidiarity, right, is not that it's a delegation of power, that these are what Robert Nisbet calls functional, autonomous units that have their own purpose and end. And so like there's a community of communities, and that the family doesn't have responsibility for military, right?
No.
Or for the courts, but the family is not, or the local community or the church or the school is not just an arm of the state, but rather its own independent element. Do you think that's a correct art? Like that seems to be the confusion. A lot of people think of subsidiarity as devolution as opposed to decentralization and autonomy.
It's the exact opposite. If I go back in the Habsburg history, one of the quotes I give is by Emperor Charles V to his son Philip II, when he says, when you are emperor over several countries, you have to respect their laws, their habits, their rights, their languages, and everything that sets them apart, or you'll be in trouble and you won't be a good emperor. So you already in the 16th century, you see a fierce respect for the so-called lower level. And the Habsburgs had that from the beginning. Right in the beginning, the first Habsburg that became king of the Holy Roman Empire, Rudolf, in 1273, immediately had to deal with an empire that wasn't a centralistic state terrorizing all the regions of the empire, but it was a very complex living together of very different entities. And in a crazy three-dimensional chess juggling act, the emperor had to keep all these things peaceful with just laws being the top lawgiver. And this got into the matrix of our family. The idea that you respect even the small and even the weakest lower level as the most important part of the whole. Now, on the other hand, in the European Union, there's a tendency to say that we need a strong central power in Brussels, and then we hand some of that power over to the lower levels. While in reality, it's different. Brussels wouldn't exist if the single nations wouldn't be sovereign and give some of their power to Brussels. And this is something that got forgotten. The Habsburgs for centuries tried to live it. And whenever they didn't live it, it went wrong. And whenever they lived it, it went wonderfully well. So we can speak from experience when we speak about this. It's simply natural. If I live in a small village, I will know best how to solve a local problem better than someone in the capital and better than someone in another country. It's very normal. And as I said, we are fiercely local. That's why I also think that we live in a time where people must be traumatized by the fact that every single medium tries to tell you that you have to save world climate by your actions. If you have more than three children, you use that much, etc. It's madness. That's absolute madness. It's madness that we should be local people responsible for saving the entire planet by deciding whether we buy this kind of food or that kind of food. This is traumatic for many people.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Dutch theologian and a Calvinist, some of my colleagues do work on his work, named Abraham Kuyper. Mm-hmm. And he had an idea called the curse of uniformity. That was a phrase he used. And then there's a Yale anthropologist named James Scott, who talks about seeing like a state. And in both the curse of uniformity or seeing like a state, everything has to be exactly the same. Everybody has to do the same things, and so there's a homogenization. So I think it's quite interesting because, you know, there's a lot of talk about diversity.
Yes.
And yet the way where there's the most diversity is in really the principle of subsidiarity, where there's this space for people to live out their freedoms and responsibilities, and centralization wants, in a sense, to make everything uniform. One of the challenges you have in Europe, and we have it increasingly in the United States, and you see this maybe from your role as ambassador to the Holy See and thinking about European life, and you see in Italy, is really just a decrease in the number of children. And so what we've heard for many years that there's going to be population bomb and everyone's going to be, you know, suffering from too much population. But what we're actually seeing is very much the opposite. Can you talk a little bit about the problem of, say, demographic decline in Europe, and what kind of impact do you think that's going to have on knowing yourself and building community and being able to, in a sense, build, you know, in one sense, your book is romantic, right? It's purposely so, I think it's romantic, but it's also trying to bring out different ways of seeing things from, say, a contemporary individualist way. What do you think this problem of demographic decline maybe articulate the problem, and then do you see some ways around it? How do you build community in a place where there's so few brothers and sisters and cousins?
This is a very serious problem that I see as a family father, that I see as an ambassador of Hungary, that I also see as a Catholic, and on many, many levels. Now, the story I usually tell is that when I arrived here in Rome and I began driving car a lot, enjoyed driving through Rome with my car. When my driver doesn't drive me, when I have to go to an event, I like to drive a lot. And one day I stop at a red traffic light and I see a pregnant woman crossing the road. And I said, wow, how beautiful. That's a pregnant woman. And then I stopped and I thought, and I said, it's the first time in 4 years that I've seen a pregnant woman crossing the road before my car. And I said, this is terrible. This is terrible because you don't see children in Rome. Italy is really just barely above the birth rate of the Vatican, more or less. It's really a terrible place. Italians mostly, I think my theory is they don't have children because they are convinced they can't afford it. And as long as the state leaves families alone, tells them if you want to have children, that's your hobby, like others have bonsais or cars and you have children, then families feel left alone. And it can be overwhelming. I don't have to tell you with seven children that it can be overwhelming to feed a family nowadays. That's why Hungary is very strongly investing into encouraging families. But the point is, having lots of children is the thing that will make you happy, your spouse happy, and that will help the state be a better place. It's not romantic, what I'm saying. Also in my book, I believe that the numerous family is the place where you learn all the virtues that you need in a modern democracy. You learn to look after the weakest. You learn to listen to others. You learn that your opinion is not the only one. You learn to put yourself not in first place. All of that you learn automatically around the dinner table in your everyday life. While if you're alone, you are convinced that you're the center of the universe. We all are, in a way. We believe that the world begins with us, ends with us. But family will teach you that this is not reality. And people who have lived in a numerous family and go out there will learn to take responsibility, will learn to work for the community outside of their families, and will often take responsibility for the state, for social work, for these. This is all a fruit of numerous families. That's why I'm trying to talk in a romantic way about the Habsburgs having lots of children and how wonderful it is to have a big family, because I know it from my own experience. But there is another level. I think that Europe is a cemetery in this case. It's a place where people never experience several children. They experience you have to work first, you have to have a huge success in your work. Then when you're close to 40, then you can have the child experience, one or two children. That very often doesn't work. Then you begin to despair and use artificial means and all of that. And you never experience what it is to have a big family and to live that. And because also you never encounter big family in movies, never encounter big family on the road. You never encounter it in advertising. There is one, maximum two children. If it's three, it's gigantic already. So it never even crosses your mind. For me, why do I have six children? First of all, because I have a generous wife, because God has been great to us. But I remember we were three at home. I regularly visited a family that had six children. They were all girls. They were all beautiful. So that helped. But I always thought, when I was there, I had the feeling of coziness, of something that I never had. And I think the more families say yes to many children, the more people will encounter normal people having lots of children, and that will help society. Because if you don't do that, and if people continue to live on that path towards being alone and reconstructing my life every few years and never taking responsibility, then the only solution for states will seem to take in as many migrants as possible from different parts of the world, because we don't have children anymore, but we need children. We need citizens. We need people who will pay our pensions. So all of this comes together in this topic of family that is one of the key topics of my book, of course.
Yeah. I think it's the example you give of learning to live with one another. You know, Mary Eberstadt, her book Primal Screams deals with this. She says that in many ways, a lot of us are like treed cats. That's the example she gives. Because the treed cat is the cat who doesn't know how to get down from the tree because they were taken away from their mother and siblings when they were young. And that many of us, we don't really know how to live as well. And I think you're right. There's a lovely homily by Joseph Ratzinger, Benedict XVI, called Love is Enough. And he says that each of us in our lives needs a Copernican revolution. We think we're the center of the universe and we have to know we're not the center of the universe. And that's, I think, hard, no matter if you're from a family of 20 or two. But nevertheless, it does make it a little easier when you have your brothers and sisters pounding on you. I think that the other issue is a question of hope. And speaking of Joseph Ratzinger, Benedict XVI, his lovely encyclical, Spes Salvi. I find most encyclicals boring, but this is a great encyclical. You're a diplomat to the Holy See, so you cannot agree with me when I said encyclicals are boring. So you don't have to. I'll let you be quiet. But Spes Salvi is a wonderful, beautiful encyclical. And really, it's about hope. And I think there's also a connection that people are not having children, not simply because they can't afford it. I think that's something you hear a lot. It's also, there's almost a loss of hope that people are seen as a scourge. Somehow they're bad for the environment, or people are just seen as a commodity. The great Italian philosopher Augusto Del Noce explains this very well, that there's this kind of commodification of the person. I mean, in one sense, I think your advice of having a big family, encouraging people to have children is really important because the action is an act of hope. And by acting, hopefully, you, in a sense, cultivate hope. But there's also the opposite, which is you need a sense of hope and purpose to do that.
Yes.
In a sense, you see Italy, for example, where you live, is in many ways a traditionally Catholic country, a family-centered country, yes, a traditional country, and yet no children. Besides the economic elements, is it a problem of hope? I mean, how should we understand that? And what do you think is the way around it? So like, I guess my point is, okay, I read your book. Let me be like provocative to you. Okay, yeah, have a big family. Okay, great. I mean, I can't afford a big family. What do you mean have a big family? That's like hard for me to grasp the concept of why do you think that? And what would you say to somebody who's struggling with, maybe they want to have a big family, but they just don't even see it as a plausible element?
Yeah. I absolutely agree with you. I think hope is incredibly important. And of course, this is another point of my book. Another point of my book is Be Catholic and Live Your Faith. How can you have hope if you don't have faith? You know, in a way, having a big family is walking across a tightrope, across a valley, and not seeing, not always being sure where that string leads. It's always in fog. It's your faith that gives you the hope to say, I believe that I will have something to put my foot upon tomorrow. In German, you say, gib der Herr ein Häschen, gib der auch ein Gräschen, which translated would be, if the Lord gives a tiny rabbit, he will also give a bit of grass. So the attitude of a Christian with hope is, I am in the hands of the Lord. We are in the hands of the Lord. Our family project is in the hands of the Lord. And it's not us, it's not our calculations, it's not our Excel sheets calculating how much I earn or not that will decide upon this. But something far bigger begins when you have a family, because this is, every single one of your children is also part of a great plan of God that leads to eternity. You build the kingdom of God with every child that grows in your family and that gets to know about God. So having a faith helps having this hope. And then, of course, you have to find a spouse that shares this set of values. Now, how people nowadays usually get together is like they go out, they find someone attractive, they have a sexual relationship for a while, then even longer, then they can't get away from each other anymore. And then at some point, then they get married. And then at some point, they might have one or two children. And by then, the relationship usually is gone. And this is the experience that many people have of family. They never have the experience of having a project, saying, I want to get married. Getting married and having children is the big and core project of my life. I look for someone who shares these values, who also is attractive, of course, heaven forgive, of course, but most of all, shares my values, has the same project, and will put everything else behind that and say, this is what we're planning. And our plan is not to live together before we get married. And once we get married, be open for children. And if you have these priorities right, if both are united in these priorities and in their faith, then the world can run against your walls and won't get through. And then the Lord will build the rest. So I'm sorry, this is the Catholic in me speaking, but most people never experience this. They go out there, they have their first sexual relations with 15, 16 in school because it's normal. And their parents say it's normal. And everybody says it's normal. And by doing this, you are burning ground for your future marriage. Every time you do this, you're burning the ground. Yes, all of this is something the Catholic Church always taught. It's not as stupid as many people think. I talk from experience. My wife and I both lived it the Catholic way, and it was the right thing to do. And we're a happily married couple after 27 years of marriage. 28. Don't tell her I said 27.
No, I'm editing that part.
Okay.
So, no, it's good. It's well, yeah, I think it's, you know, John Paul II in his beautiful book, Love and Responsibility, talks about, you know, how each of us is a subject and that we're called to intersubjective relationships where we respect one another. And I think the challenge also though is, and I think you're aware of this, is, you know, a lot of people are wounded as you've kind of indicated. I mean, they've wounded maybe because their parents are divorced. They've wounded because they've been in bad relationships. And so a lot of these things seem not possible. And I think one of the things we have to do is create what the sociologist Peter Berger, I like this line, he talks about plausibility structures, right? The idea that it's plausible to actually do these things. And this is where we go back to your point of why you need to have community and why family is so important, because it's going to be mutually reinforcing. Yes. Or it's going to be fragmented. And so it's a difficult situation.
And it also helps if you are friends with other families that have lots of children. So if the first friends of your children are children from families with many children, they will feel encouraged that this path is a good one. Now, we had our first grandchild now, but all of my children so far tell me their experience of large family was a good one, and they all want to have lots of children. That gives me an incredible amount of hope. So you're absolutely right. Community is very important, because when you're in school, you're probably surrounded by people who think very differently from you, and you're the odd one out if you have these experiences. But if you have cousins, friends, families, parish friends that think like you and live like you, you'll be encouraged to go on like that.
Yeah, I think that plausibility and that it's possible, and that's the way to see it. I think it's right. There's many things we could talk about, but I know we don't have that much time. So I'd like to talk about a couple of things in your book, especially some of the great stories. So one of the things I'd like to ask you about is Blessed Carl. And maybe tell about him a little bit and what should people know about him. And this may be surprisingly that, so he was the last like acting emperor. And he is a blessed in the Holy Roman Church, in the Catholic Church. And so on the way to sainthood, right? Yes. And then his son, Otto, who died in 2011?
Yes.
Okay. At the age of, I think, 98, wasn't he?
Yes.
So he was the heir to the throne that was then the Habsburg Empire after World War I. And I think I mentioned to you, I actually met Otto von Habsburg at a conference. Yes. And I got to talk to him. I have a lovely picture with him in Rome. Quite an interesting experience. I mean, here I was talking to this man whose father was the last emperor.
Yes. I was not only able to talk to him, but I was also able to meet Blessed Emperor Karl's widow, his wife, Empress Sita, and spoke to her a few times when I was a child. So I have a similar experience. Now, the great thing about Blessed Carl, I'll begin with Twitter. I made a Habsburg World Championship a few months ago on Twitter. I took 16 male, 16 female Habsburgs from the centuries, the greatest and most famous Habsburgs over the centuries. Everybody has ideas about, seen paintings, read books about. And then I let them play like in a football championship. People could choose, you know, favorites. Every week, four male, four female, you could, and the two made it to the next round, etc. I made it like a football tournament. And it was democratic. I asked people to vote. I didn't influence that. And after about a month of Habsburg championship, the female Habsburg to win was Empress Maria Theresia from the 18th century, famous mother of 16 children. And the male was Blessed Emperor Karl, who was, as you said correctly, the last Habsburg emperor who only ruled for 1.5 years during the First World War, who managed to lose the throne, lose the war, didn't manage to take back the throne in Hungary twice, and died a few months later miserably in exile. And this is the man that is the most popular Habsburg in 2023. Not only within our family, because I made an unofficial poll in my family. I asked on our WhatsApp, we have a WhatsApp group in the family. And I asked the young ones, who's your favorite? And they all said Blessed Karl. Not only there, but also on Twitter of all places. So you will ask me why. And it's very interesting because I think because he is a very relatable Habsburg, but at the same time, he is going to be a saint one day. He's on his way to sainthood. His way to sainthood was, as one of his descendants told me, he was a great family father, a loving husband. He was a good Catholic, and he did his job well and filled with faith, and his job happened to be emperor for 1.5 years. And that's incredibly relatable. The way he became a saint was the way you could become a saint and I could become a saint, as a family father doing our job well. So that is one part of it. Then he was incredibly gentle. And I think he was a gentle, friendly, warm-hearted man who looked after his subjects when he was emperor. He was in the trenches of the First World War before he became emperor. So he knew about the horrors of war. He was also one of the strongest advocates of peace during the First World War, following the cry of Pope Benedict XV, to finally make peace. But he was simply incredibly nice, warm-hearted, gentle, deep Catholic. And all of that together makes many historians who followed my Twitter thing, they were furious that the Blessed Karl won. Why not Charles V? Why not Franz Joseph? In the end, it was this quiet, friendly family father from the 20th century. So that is quite something. And if you want to know more about him, there is a little booklet. It's called The Death of an Emperor. You can order it on the internet, because I think 50% of the reason why he was beatified was the way he died. He died in exile from a disease of the lungs, of bronchitis. He died slowly in incredible pain, offering up his suffering for his family, for his peoples, for all the people who did him wrong, and dying like a saint with the eyes towards the Blessed Sacrament, in prayer with his family. It's incredible. And reading this little volume will change your relation to Blessed Karl. So it's called Death of an Emperor. You can order it online at the Prayer League, and it's 100% worthwhile. It's also a quick read. You can read it in a few hours. And last year was the centenary of his death. He died in 1922 on the 1st of April. And on that day on Twitter, I made a Twitter Spaces where I read the entire booklet online. And in the end, I was so in tears, I couldn't read the last one or two pages because I was so moved by it. But everybody was. So Blessed Emperor Karl is really a strong example. And, you know, my book is called The Seven Rules for Turbulent Times. And while I wrote this, I always tried to give you examples who in the Habsburg history lived these seven values. And Blessed Karl, I would say, checks all seven boxes full. There is a few Habsburgs over the centuries that checked five of those, even six of those. The two of them who really checked all seven was Blessed Karl and was Maria Theresia, who was the other who won the Habsburg championship. So he's really an exemplary Habsburg, even if he was only emperor for 1.5 years and in the eyes of the world was a loser. There is many historians out there, many people who don't even know he exists. But for us Habsburgs and for Twitter, he's the greatest Habsburg.
Yeah. It's great. So I think that's it's very beautiful. I mean, in a sense, because it goes back to, I think your, a lot of the themes that are in your book and, but also the themes of our conversation, that it's not enough to be a great man. You must be a good man. Yes. And what you see here, I think it's like in the eyes of the world, he was a loser. That's what you said. But what you saw was he was a father, a husband, a person who did his job well, who was faithful to the church. And in that, I think it's an inspiration to all of us, right?
So he was also a great inspiration to St. John Paul II, in as that he was called Karol because his father was a great admirer of Emperor Karl. And he was named after him. That's also one of the reasons why John Paul II wanted to not only beatify him, but canonize him, and also his wife, because he thought they were a saintly couple, Empress Zita and Emperor Karl. Her process for beatification has begun now. And as I told you, I've met her. And meeting her, you got an idea of how he was.
I'll put a link up. So give me that link. I'll put a link up on the moralimagination.com website on this for this podcast episode. And so you can get, I'll put a link up to Death of the Emperor there. Two more things to talk about. One related to death is you talk about this and the end of your book, a story that I actually know, which was great. I told you I used to give a lecture a lot called Christian Vision of Government. And I did it for the Acton Institute, and you can actually see the lecture. I can put a link up to that. Listeners, you can see the lecture. And I talk about 10 things that Christianity brings to our understanding of politics. But at the end of this lecture, I give a story about how the Habsburg funeral goes. And the point of the story is that one of the key elements of understanding a Christian understanding of politics is that politics is not the end. The state is not the final arbiter of justice. The state is not going to redeem us. We're not going to be redeemed by technology or the state. Again, Joseph Ratzinger, Spes Salvi, Benedict XVI is very good on this. But there's a wonderful story about the funeral of the emperor. Could you walk us through that lovely story? I've seen video of it, but you've seen it twice. Is that correct?
Twice.
Wow, yes. What amazing. And I've been to that church, actually. I know the church, and it's a beautiful church. So but maybe could you just walk us through and tell us, how does the funeral work? And I think it's, in one sense, it tells it itself, but maybe you could give a little commentary on it as well.
Yes. Well, one of the core points of my books is that the Habsburgs were fiercely aware that they would have to render accountability one day to God about how they lived as emperors and as rulers and as sovereigns. And they knew that their final judgment was not the state, as you just said, Michael, but was going to be God. So they did everything in their power to have not only a just, but also a merciful God meeting them after their death. And one of the things they were very aware of was that their death was going to be watched by their subjects, because the subjects take the cue of how a good Christian dies from their sovereign, and their funeral was going to be watched. And they used their funeral as a sermon. And having been there twice, because, I mean, we didn't live in the monarchy anymore when this happened, but for tradition's sake, for Empress Zita and also for Otto's funeral in Vienna, which incorporated a huge procession through the center of Vienna, you can find videos of that everywhere. In the end, the coffin of the emperor arrives in the heart of Vienna at the Kapuzinerkirche, the Capuchins, and just beside the church is a little door, and that's where a very steep stair goes down to the crypt where all the Habsburgs are buried, the Kapuzinergruft. And the master of ceremonies, and I just spoke to the man who was master of ceremonies at Zita's funeral, because he is the current ambassador of Liechtenstein of the Order of Malta to Hungary. And we talked about this just a few weeks ago. I sat with him and we talked about that moment where the master of ceremonies knocks at the door. And a voice from inside, a Capuchin, says, "Who is there?" And the master says, "Zita, Empress of Austria, Queen of Hungary, Queen of Bohemia, Queen of Croatia," and all the titles for about 30 seconds. And the voice from inside says, "We don't know her." And then he knocks again. And the voice says, "Who is there?" And then they list up all the achievements of the emperor, like, Emperor Augustus also listed up all the achievements of his life. So they list up everything this emperor did in his life. And again, the voice says, "We don't know her." And then he knocks a third time and the voice says, "Who goes there?" And then he says, "Zita, a poor, sinful woman. And that's it. And the door opens. And this is whom God knows, a sinner, a poor sinner. And this is something that people were listening to at the funeral of their emperor. And they realized, wow, even this person that wore golden crowns and was rich and had all that splendor of court, in the end, was a poor, sinful man. This is something that goes back through the whole of the Habsburg history. I give examples of how Emperor Maximilian used his own death as a sermon about his sinfulness. And the Habsburgs were, as I said at the beginning, very aware that they would be judged in a special way because they had a terrible responsibility as emperors. And therefore, they wanted to make it clear that they were sinners, poor, poor sinners.
It's a powerful thing. It was striking to me when I first learned about it years before. And then when I prepared this lecture, to think about that as an example, right? So like in contrast to, say, the dominant pagan view of government, that there were the state is divine, Caesar's divine, right? The emperor's divine. And what Christianity does is it desacralizes the state, right? It says that the state is not divine.
Yes.
The state has it's natural, it has a role, but it sees that in a sense that the state has an important role, but it is not the source of our salvation. It is not the arbiter of justice. And I think that what that funeral does is it's really the one of the ways I describe it is that it's prudent, meaning it sees the world as it is,
yes,
that there is a God and yes, that we're under judgment, and that even yes, the emperor to the peasant, the lowest peasant, yes, the highest, is under the judge of merciful and loving God. And I think it's a very beautiful story about, in a sense, a proper role. And, you know, good Christians can disagree about lots of the roles of the state, but ultimately the state is not divine, and the totalitarian impulse, I think I would say the secular temptation is to divinize the state. The religious temptation is to politicize religion. And as Ratzinger yes, says, you know, that leads to unbelief.
Yes.
As we've
yes,
seen. But a proper relationship, it's hard to get a proper relationship. And, you know, I'm not saying that the Habsburgs always had the proper relationship, but I think that funeral, that standard is just very, very beautiful and quite a telling ritual.
I also think, Michael, that politicians nowadays, I think the greatest temptation for our politicians nowadays, apart from narcissism, I think, is hubris. I think many people have a feeling that our leaders have a hubris, that they feel like little gods who can do whatever they want. And a healthy dose of memento mori would change our leaders' approach. I think that's the difference. I think most political leaders were still Christians 50 years ago. This has gone away. And if you're not rooted humbly before God, then you will think that you are the king of the universe if you are in the leadership position.
All right. I think that's right. I mean, this is part of the technocracy and the transhumanism.
Yes.
Is that there's a loss of a sense that we're creatures with great dignity, but we're not God. And the idea of the transhumanist is to, in a sense, turn ourselves into God. And this is a dangerous place. We're almost out of time here. If you don't mind, I just would like one more quick question. So one of the things that you mentioned in your book that's very interesting, just kind of interesting element that most people maybe don't know about, is the golden fleece. And so you talk about this idea of the golden fleece. And so you also you're in the Order of Malta and an ambassador for the Order of Malta. Is that right? So
yes,
maybe talk a little bit about the Order of Malta, just for people who don't know what it is, but also the Order of the Golden Fleece, which I think, how many are there? Like,
there
15?
Is never more than 50.
Only 15 people in the Order of Golden Fleece.
50. And among, we are, I think, about 45 or something like that right now.
And, 40, okay, for right now, yeah.
Yes, but it's, no, okay. All of the Golden Fleece is something quite impressive because I'm actually not that much into decorations and orders, not really. I live very strongly in the 21st century and in current culture. But the Golden Fleece was always something very, very special for me. This is an order that came into the family by marriage. Maximilian of Habsburg married Mary of Burgundy, and whose grandfather had founded the Order of the Golden Fleece. And it's a knightly order that really has very strong values, very strong faith relation. We have a beautiful prayer that we pray. And it's a striking decoration, this golden hanging sheep fleece that you wear around your neck. And it is the order associated with Habsburgs. If you're in a picture gallery and somebody is wearing a golden fleece around their neck, you can almost be sure that it's either a Habsburg or a close ally of the Habsburgs. And so this is something absolutely beautiful. It stands for tradition. It stands for being loyal to the head of the family, of the Habsburg family, friendship and loyalty. The Order of Malta, I am ambassador of Hungary to the Order of Malta. I'm also a member of the Order. The Order of Malta, of course, is known throughout the world mostly for its helping the poor, the emarginated, the hungry, the refugees. And the Order has its seat in Rome. It's a complicated two-headed thing. On the one hand, it's a sovereign order. On the other hand, it's an order. So as a sovereign entity, it has its own stamps. It has its own ambassadors. On the other hand, it's an order of the Catholic Church. Therefore, it is under the Pope. And this mix of two things led to a lot of tensions in the last 5 or 6 years, mostly between the Holy See and inside the order, different factions of the order. Pope Francis seems to have found a good solution for all of this in the last months. And I think the Order of Malta is now on a trajectory that is very, very good. In fact, I hear that there is new vocations for becoming Fras, you know, professed knights. And I think after many years of tension, a sort of peace has returned to the order. So yes, this is two things that somehow look like something from the past, but are still very present in present day. I have a whole passage in my book where I speak about rites and forms, about protocol and all these things that seem totally outdated in our 21st century, but that are very important because they help us. They help us in encounter. They help us in everyday life. We live of these things, and Habsburgs were very aware of them. So I speak a bit about that in one of the chapters of my books.
Yeah, I think maybe we can end there. I just think it's an interesting point because one of the challenges we have in modern life is this individualism that Tocqueville warned us about, that we feel alone and lonely. And so this is why family is important. This is why community is important. But also, I do think it's why rights are important. And that's R-I-T-E-S, rights. Yes. Not just human rights, but human rights. That is why liturgy is important. And so I've actually had a couple of conversations about that on the podcast. But a friend of mine explains it, I think, very beautifully. It sounds very pedantic, but I think it's very powerful. It's one of the things that takes place when you have traditions and protocols is what's called non-linguistic catechesis, right? And if we think about it, let's talk about it through the Catholic liturgy, because both of us are Catholics. But you have explanation and articulation, say, of faith or family or loyalty. But yes. You also have symbolic representation, which is a teaching that's non-linguistic, right? So for example, let's take a Catholic Matt, we could talk a liturgy that we know about, simple, and you could maybe give another example of this, but at one point in the Mass, the altar boy, the acolyte will come out and incense. After he incenses the priest incenses the altar, and then the acolyte will incense the others, and then come out and actually incense the people. And the people all stand up, they bow, they get incense, they sit down, and then you enter into the Mass of the Faithful, is what it's called.
Yes.
Well, that's actually a very beautiful non-linguistic representation that you're called to be a people set apart. And then when you hear about Linus, Cletus, Clement, Sixtus, Cornelius, right, you realize you're part of something. Yes. Abraham, our patriarch, right? And that you're brought into something. And I think it's a very important element why liturgy is very important, and also why community is very important, but also why what appears to be from the outside unnecessary ritual is, in fact, what the Catholic anthropologist Mary Douglas maybe calls condensed symbols.
Yes.
That reflect that we are embodied, we're embedded, we're part of something that we, that, and it humanizes us. And so we can look at it as something kind of pseudo aristocratic or something from the past. But in fact, the human beings, because we're embodied, because we're embedded, because we have a social nature, we need these rights. And so I think that's just an interesting part. I mean, I've spoken a lot there, but do you want to make a comment?
Michael, I 100% agree on that. You know, God respects our body so much that we will rise with our bodies, not only with our souls. So the old lex orandi, lex credendi, the way you pray will shape your faith, is true. And what I discovered was that, you know, they say the devil has no knees. And for me, the point where I feel it most of all is kneeling. I've begun to kneel more during prayer, even during my everyday prayers when I'm at home, when I, for instance, during the Angelus at 12, I've begun kneeling down at the third part where it says, and the world become flesh. The more often you kneel down, the more your body remembers who God is and that you're not God's best baseball buddy, but that he is the creator of heaven and earth and you are creation. Your body learns it, and through your body, your mind, your brain, your soul will be shaped in this. This is a very simple thing. We have dropped kneeling from our liturgy because we think it's sort of, it makes you small and it's old fashioned, but kneeling reminds you of who God is and who you are. And therefore, I think that ritual is very helpful, is very, very helpful. And when my great, 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 and a few more great grandfather, Ferdinand II, when he was a young boy, when he got up in the morning, he was in a Jesuit school. That was, we're talking 17th century, just before the 30-year war. He got up and he knelt immediately down and said his morning prayers kneeling. And Marie Antoinette did the same in her instructions to her daughter, to the court of France. Her mother tells her, get up, get on your knees and say your morning prayers after getting up. This is something that, you know, that helps us get a perspective. So I wholeheartedly agree with what you say about ritual and about forms.
Yeah, no, it's very good. There's actually, I can put some links in the show notes to this. St. Dominic of the Dominican Order. St. Dominic has things on prayer posture. It's a Benedictine. Gabriel Bunge writes in his book, Earthen Vessels, about the importance of prayer. I can put a link to that. C.S. Lewis, a great C.S. Lewis, talks about this. And of course, Joseph Ratzinger talks about kneeling, standing, hands folded, how it comes, all the connections.
Yes.
And these are, these things are, as you point out, and you touched upon, Edward, one of the big themes of this podcast that we're embodied, embedded, that we're not driving around in our body like we're driving around in a car.
No.
We are embodied.
We're not a soul, a soul tied to a decomposing body. We are body and soul. 100%.
St. Thomas says, St. Thomas says, I am not my soul. And
no.
And so that's, and I think, and like that, this idea of embodied existence, and I think we could do a whole other conversation on this, but I think this is also the challenge of just how to live well in a world with digital technology, which gives us many benefits. Listeners know I wrote a little book called Digital Contagion, of how to live better and use technology a little bit better, but how to live well, because in many sense, as you've articulated, we're in a sense pulled away from our embodiment and embeddedness.
Disembodied. Modern technology disembodies us.
Absolutely. And so you have to, and you said this earlier, we have to make a conscious effort to do that. So, well, Edward, I'm very thankful for this conversation. I learned a lot in talking to you, and it's fun to read about the Habsburgs. And maybe you could just tell us before we finish, you also write children's books and other things. Just maybe a couple of other things that you've worked on that listeners could know about.
Well, first of all, I want to encourage all your listeners to follow me on Twitter. This is the place where I currently mostly write, mostly in tweets, but this is where
Edward, you're breaking your whole technological. I mean, you're like, you've bought in to it. I'm just teasing you.
Yeah, I'm gone. That's why I have to fight against it. No, but I love it far too much. And I'm still in the wonderful situation that I can react to people. I can react to direct messages. I still only have 65,000 followers, and I can still react. So I can also interact, and I just want to encourage your followers to follow me on Twitter and to reach out, to interact, to answer. This is where I write currently. Now, the thing you can read, but you can read articles by me all over the internet. I wrote a little children's book, which is a companion piece, I think, if you want, to my book. It's called Dubby, the Double Eagle. And it's a funny little children's book about the Habsburg coat of arms, a little double eagle coming alive today and having an adventure. It's also, you will find the grown-ups reading the books to the children will have many things for them too. So you will find a lot of criticism of what's going on currently. I've written books about James Bond, Harry Potter, castles. I've written screenplays, one about zombies, historic police stories, love stories. I've written so much in my life. But if you want to read something, you can read The Habsburg Way. You can read Dubby, the Double Eagle. And I think that's mostly it. The rest is in German, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, I'll put links up to Dubby, the Double Eagle, and of course, the Habsburg Way, and links to your Twitter account. Thank you, Edward, very much for taking time to talk to me on the Moral Imagination podcast.
Thank you for a great conversation that elevated my status. I feel far more intelligent now than before.
Okay. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Thank you.